I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
If you enjoy listening to the LRB podcast, then you'll probably enjoy reading the LRB. You can subscribe to the LRB from just £1 per issue. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link in the description below this episode.
Hello and welcome to the London Review of Books podcast. My name is Thomas Jones, and this week I'm talking to John Lanchester, a contributing editor at the LRB and author of many books, most recently Reality and Other Stories. He has a piece in the current issue of the paper on cheating in sport, or more specifically on the things you see happen while you're watching or playing a game that are against its rules, but sometimes within its ethos. Hello, John, and thank you very much for joining me again.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So the Olympics are underway and Great Britain have won their first medals. But as you say in the piece, the kind of cheating you're interested in isn't the kind that goes on, or can go on, I should say, at the Olympics. Especially doping and everything around doping, which comes under the rubric of what you call invisible cheating. You talk about visible cheating, and in football, if we begin with football, the question of diving on the one hand and professional fouls on the other. And there were sort of two classic examples of diving that you mentioned in your piece toward in the final rounds of Euro 2020. One was Immobile and the other was Sterling. So I don't know if you want to talk a bit about what they did and why it was okay or wasn't okay.
Yeah, no, well, it's the thing that interests me, this distinction between breaking the rules, but, you know, it's kind of what professionals do, and stuff that's over the line. And maybe the commonest form of that is just diving. It's exaggerating contact. The highest level of it, I think, the highest level of the art is when there is faint contact, but the player goes down as if properly fouled. And the really classic examples of the genre, the best of them are when the first time you watch it, you actually think it's a foul. I remember Michael Owen in one of the World Cups, his Star World Cup, which one was that? It was one of the 2000 World Cups, went through and appeared to be brutally hacked down in the penalty area by an Argentine defender. And then actually when you watch it again, it wasn't clear there was any contact at all. And I was watching it with a non-England supporting friend who annoyed me at the time by saying, you know, the thing is, it was such a good dive, it deserved a penalty. And then in hindsight, actually, I think that is a category, you know. I mean, there is a contact. They go down like they've just been sniped and the penalty is awarded. And you see that all the time. Sterling's very good at it. Kane's very good at it. Despite the fact that historically we've regarded that as the exclusive province of cheating foreigners. Actually, English players have got very, very accomplished at that. And I think it's fair to say that the penalty Sterling won in the semi-final against Denmark was in that category. And then Immobile, was it against Spain or was it in the group stage?
Quarterfinal, maybe, I think.
Quarterfinal, maybe. And that was sort of slightly more in the arena of pure physical comedy. Which Keaton and Chaplin would have been proud that there's sort of non-contact. He, as I say, goes down like he's been sniped by a Barrett 50 at 1 kilometre range, kind of collapses in a heap. And then about 10 seconds later, I think Chiesa maybe from the same move then stuck the ball in the net, at which point Immobile simply sort of looked around and you'd have thought it was an oxymoron and sheepishly celebrated. The ensuing goal, you know, he sort of got up. I think my memory is he sort of looked over his shoulder to check that thing that no one's watching, and then jogged across to join in the celebrations, having apparently been, you know, touch and go whether he was alive.
but it is one of those things. It says, it, you know, when the ball goes off, both teams claim the throw-in. I mean, there's a sense, or in cricket, when you claim LBW, I mean, I know that you have to claim it to get it, but there's a sense in which if you've been fouled, you've been touched, in a sense, the severity of it doesn't matter. The other player, he's touched you, he hasn't got the ball, you've lost the ball, you want to go down in the hope of getting the free kick, you want to make sure the ref has seen the foul. I mean, there's a sense in which it's a big pitch, you need to signal largely to convey the fact of the foul as you perceive it.
Well, there is an element of referee management. I think the thing about, there's a Tom Stoppard's play about, I think it was initially a radio play.
Yeah, Professional Foul.
Professional Foul. And he actually makes that point about the fact that every single time the ball goes into touch, without exception, both players appeal. You know, that there's something kind of exhausting and... It's interesting. You could argue there's a decadence in that there's no attempt to play according to any sense of what the spirit of the game might be, that you know perfectly well. Because every single time, the, you know, players, 99% of the time, players know who touched it last, but they never admit it. And that is like saying the code of the game demands that you cheat, effectively. You know you kicked it out, but you're never going to admit it. I mean, it's an interesting contrast with the days when the penalty first came in. The Corinthians, who were the posh amateur team, penalties were, you know, weren't always part of football. They were invented, you know, the journalist Robert McCrum. Mm. They were invented by his grandfather.
Oh, really?
Who's a senior figure in football, association football, as they would have called it, in Northern Ireland. Yeah, so McCrum's grandfather invented the penalty. And it was controversial among some circles in football, like the Corinthians, because it implied that they deliberately fouled a man. They would have said, if you foul a man in the penalty area, it's dishonourable. So the Corinthians wouldn't defend penalties. The goalkeeper would stand next to the post on one side and allow the opposition to tap the ball in, because the imputation against their honour was so offensive that, you know, you had no choice but to concede a goal. Now, that spirit has completely gone. I mean, obviously, it seems a bit ridiculous from a modern perspective, but that whole side is just entirely absent from football, from professional football, but even from, you know, the football I see being, you know, around the corner from the common, there's often a dozen games going on marked pitches at the weekend. And, you know, it's just a different code. You know, the ball goes off, both players appeal. And it sort of barely, although, you know, obviously, in some sense, it is cheating. It doesn't count. It's fully within the ethos, spirit of the game, that you do exaggerate contact, you do appeal.
There is a psychological element. I mean, it's one of the things that always baffled me about McEnroe's in tennis, his shouting about that the ball was in when it was clearly out. And there was no way the umpire's going to change the decision. So it's that. And in football as well, when there's a yellow card and the players all appeal against it. I mean, there's never been an occasion where a referee has gone, oh, no, actually, guys, you're quite right. I'm sorry. Puts the card back in his pocket and crosses the name off in the book. I mean, that's never happened. I mean, I don't know if McEnroe's ever talked about why he did it, but if he needed to sort of convince himself, because if you concede that you're hitting the ball out, does the psychological game collapse? Do you need to sort of work yourself up into believing that you're... And I wonder if there's that aspect of it with the throw-in in football as well. If you go, oh, no, mate, you take it. It's your... I kicked it off. Silly me. You then concede a massive psychological advantage to the other team. Well, not massive, but enough of some kind of psychological advantage.
But those things are complicated because... Well, I think there's a lot to unpick there. Maybe we'll come back to McEnroe. I think he's a slightly separate case. I mean, I think there's a question with him of the extent to which the tantrums were a form of cheating. You know, that he was capable of either genuinely or apparently completely losing his temper. And then he would, I think it was one of the reasons I loved and admired him as a player technically, but I always felt that the tantrums, maybe the plural should be tantra, but the tantrums were on the edge of being a form of cheating, because he would fully recover and the opponent often wouldn't. You know, they were like, I think Clive James actually said, you know, it was like a toddler having the kind of tantrum that every adult in the room is still shaking 5 minutes later, but the toddler's fully recovered in a second. You know, and they would often happen at important moments in the match, and the momentum would shift. And that was my although I loved and admired him as a player, I also, you know, I bluntly, when he was playing Borg, I wanted Borg to win because I felt he was playing within the spirit of the game and McEnroe wasn't, because of, to me, artificiality of some of those outbursts and things. The thing about the, you know, surrounding the ref or yelling at the ref and all that, I think the issue, though, is it's often counterproductive, you know, that you put, the ref is then put on his mettle to not show that he's being manipulated. You know, that thing about if someone's makes a huge fuss and drama, it becomes important to the referee to show that they're not influenced by it. And yeah, I think it actually might be very effective to say, no, I did kick it last, and save it for when it does really matter, which is something that they often do in rugby. The thing about, you know, I mentioned in the piece, Sam Warburton said the best advice he was ever given was by Roman Poit, the referee. He said, you know, you can speak to me twice a half, three times if I'm having a bad game.
And a bit like the challenges in tennis.
Like the challenges in tennis. Yeah. Though they don't, the challenges in tennis are without the element of psychological manipulation. They're just a clear cut thing where there's a...
Well, they are, but I wonder, there are moments, you sometimes see people that it's out, it's clearly out, but it's towards the end of the set, it's an important moment, they've lost momentum, and they challenge a ball which they know they're not going to win the challenge, but it buys them time in that same way that what you're saying about McEnroe's tantrums. They can be used as a way of, if not regaining the momentum of the match, at least kind of slowing the opponent.
Sure, but they're finite, they're limited. You know, it's not like a McEnroe tantrum which could go on for 10 minutes. and it's also not the thing about the, you know, the tone of voice in which the player chat. Well, there isn't a tone of voice; they just gesture usually. Whereas the thing about the way that captains speak to the referee in rugby is, it very often is the better they are at it, the lighter their touch. You know, someone like Alan Wynne-Jones, the Lions captain at the moment, he's a master at dealing with referees because he has this tremendous presence and authority as a player, most capped player in the history of the game. Just made this miraculous recovery, 4 weeks from a dislocated shoulder, so he's back playing in the test team. But he never harangues, he never berates, and he usually just asks a question. And that's clearly, I think, more effective. You know, they don't try and evidently manipulate. They don't try and tell the referee what to think. The kind of, you know, I wonder if tone actually clearly works quite well with referees, because they do tend to be counter-suggestible, I think.
So the reasons for the mobbing the referee, as you say, they're not expecting to change the decision. It must have something to do, I don't know if it's somehow connected with that need, the sort of the hunger to win, and know that somehow if you start being nervous of fouling, or nervous that you're breaking the rules, or nervous that you're the one kicking it off, not that they ever would because they're professionals, and it so, but there must be some reason why they do it.
Well, I think the mobbing, I mean, the team that notoriously did it quite often were Alex Ferguson's Man United, and I think that was part of part of an adversarial culture, that they were very, a sense of being hard done by, a sense of us against the world, a very strong sense of a sort of internally generated sense of unfairness. You know, that was a big thing in the team, and notoriously that did seem to work. You had that thing of what's called Fergie time, with Manchester United being allowed extra minutes, especially when they played at home, especially when they were behind. You know, that was the perception anyway. And even though, as you correctly point out, you know, the referee doesn't then say, oh, okay, I'll take the yellow card back, it can have an effect on the team's psychology, and it can have an effect on the tenor of the game. You know, Ferguson's a very astute man. If he didn't think that was helping, he'd have told his players to stop doing it.
And a football player, well, who in some ways he does have a bit more of that willingness to concede when he's fouled, and sort of friendliness and appearance of behaving reasonably towards the ref sometimes, is the Italian captain, Giorgio Chiellini, who's sort of a great master of, as you say in the piece, of what's called shithousery. I mean, there's a Twitter account called Football Shithousery, as there's a Twitter account called Everything. And 10 days ago, it showed, or appeared to show, an Italy fan's tattoo of Chiellini pulling Saka's shirt in the final. That moment when he just flagrantly grabbed his shirt, pulled him off, pulled him over. And my children, aged 11 and 8, and they have both Italian and British citizenship, so they'd taken uncomplicated enjoyment in the semi-finals, but were supporting Italy in the final, but they were shocked by that, by the shirt pulling. But an Italian friend watching the game with us said, but you know, you take the, it's, if he looks like he's going to score, you take the yellow card. It's part of the game. It's within the ethos. And the other thing that Chiellini did that in the semi-final against Spain before the penalties, and the moment that that game was won, it seemed to me, was drawing the coin toss for the penalties. Chiellini was joking around, and what a Francophile friend of mine called his faux bonhomie. That was the moment when they won, because the extent to which penalties are about the psychology and sort of all the back-patting and joking, and the Spanish captain sort of seemed to crumble in the face of it. And my children couldn't see what was wrong with that. They said, oh, well, he's just being friendly. So there are these ways of, was he cheating? Was Chiellini joking about before the penalties? Would that be?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, there's elements of psychological manipulation and stuff in sport that isn't cheating. You know, the Corinthians probably wouldn't approve. But because penalty shootouts are substantially about psychology. And, you know, there have been occasions in the past when, I can't remember, I have a picture in my head, but I don't remember who the players are, like somebody walking over to shake the penalty taker's hand as he's lining up. You know, that's over the line. But just if, you know, the kind of fakely jokey tone didn't seem to me. I mean, I thought, you know, players have been taking yellow cards rather than conceding goals since the dawn of time. I thought I've seen things like that given as red because of the risk to the player's head. Rugby now is having a huge thing about head contact. Anything that bumps a player's head is a red card. And I thought Chiellini pulling his shirt, pulling him back, knocking him off his feet, that you'd see all day. But actually, I thought there was a reckless component to the way he grabbed the shirt and Saka's head went back. You know, he doesn't normally do it quite as obviously as that. It was right at the end of the game. He was a bit tired. You know, as I say, if the referee had given it as a red card, you'd have been a bit surprised, but you wouldn't have said, you know, that's never happened in the history of football before. I thought Italy would win the final. And the reason I thought that was that, is this thing around the way that Italians defend? And Chiellini and Bonucci, you know, they come out of that tradition where, as a friend of mine once said, you can watch a whole season of Serie A and not see a defender have a clear header in the penalty, and a forward have a clear header on goal in a whole season. And they come out, Chiellini and Bonucci come out of that tradition where it's on the edge of shithousery, cheating, or it's just how Italian defenders defend, that there's a constant niggle to get the forward off balance, pull his shirt, you know, as we're and the shirt pulling, standing on the foot, bumping, all that. It doesn't happen when the ball is in the air coming over for the cross while the referee is looking. It's before that. So by the time pulls a shirt, bumps him, steps on his foot, whatever, then the cross is struck and the forward is just off balance. They can't jump. They don't get off the ground, you know, and it looks like a bad cross or a cross that doesn't go anywhere. It looks like something that was never on. And it's not that. It's just very good defending. And another thing they do very well is they block, you know, they have between them, they're 70 years old. They have a huge depth of experience and they block runs. They stand in front of the place. You know, they know where the forward wants to go. They know the pattern they want to play. They're just in the way. And a lot of that very high level defending of that kind of technical type, it's about things that, it's not the sort of astonishing header they win or the, you know, Bobby Moore on Pelé tackle from 90, you know, it's not what you see. It's stuff that they prevent happening. It's like a negative force field. It's sort of like what art critics talk about, negative space. That's the thing that is extraordinary about people like Chiellini and Bellucci. It's stuff that doesn't occur is the measure of how good they are at what they do. And that side of it was actually what I thought would, along with Verratti and Jorginho running the midfield, that I thought that would be just a bit too much for this England team where they are now. And it sort of was, you know, that there were that thing about, you know, almost no chances, that thing, you know, no clean headers, no clean runs on goal, no space in the penalty area, all that. I mean, that's the thing that they're absolute geniuses at. It's not thrilling, but it's technically, you know, it's technically extraordinary to see.
On the question of Italian defenders, what about the moment in the 2006 World Cup final, which France lost to Italy, when Marco Materazzi said something to Zinedine Zidane, which caused Zidane to headbutt Materazzi in the chest, knocking him down. And Zidane, of course, was sent off. I mean, that's a whole different level of professional foul, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And really quite a striking thing about, you know, a code that's not about what happens in the game. You clearly said something that, you know, Zidane felt impugned his honour to such a level that he had no choice but to do what he did. And it was very interesting, I thought, there wasn't a storm of condemnation around that. You know, when you compare it to something like the Maradona handball from 86, that it was sort of, there was this sort of weird, almost acceptance of, you know, well, Materazzi's of evil cheating psychopath and he did what evil cheating psychopaths do. And Zidane is a sort of, you know, genius who plays by his own code and had no choice except to headbutt him off his feet. Though interestingly, he didn't, you know, if he was going to headbutt him, he could have put him in hospital if he headbutted him hard enough to knock him off his feet. And he didn't do that. I mean, that was quite odd and strange. It wasn't, it was sort of almost a formal protest rather than an act of maximum. Because if you headbutt him in the face, he'd have, Materazzi would have ended up in hospital and Zidane could well have ended up in jail. So it was a really strange operatic moment, that.
And kind of magnificent, I thought. I mean, the sense that there are, this is the World Cup final and some things matter.
But some things matter more, yeah. No, that was really interesting. I was in France at the time and I think, you know, oddly enough, I think an English player who did that, there would have been much more, there would have been a tabloid thing about, you know, idiot costs England the World Cup.
Well, like Beckham kicking the, when he was
down. Yeah, when he was wound up and kicked, whoever it was, back-heeled him. You know, idiot costs England the World Cup would have been the reaction. But that wasn't the reaction at all in France. It was, you know, as it were, you know, man's got to do what a man's got to do.
But also the difference that Beckham against the Argentina when he, you know, he was a young, there's no sense in which Zidane would have done anything other than sort of deliberately. And
yeah, no, it wasn't hot-headed, oddly.
No, because didn't he walk away? He started walking away and then he turned around and came back.
I don't remember it that vividly. Yeah.
The movie, but the Hollywood version in my head may not be quite right. But
And also, presumably, he'd been doing it all game as well.
But the anger that can provoke. I mean, just remember playing at school at one occasion, this guy on the other team. And I'm not sure I've ever been so angry with anyone in my entire life as that. Just this constant needling anger and the kind of wish to kill somebody. It was ridiculous. It was a game of school football, but it was.
There are definitely players who use that to their advantage. I mean, I think the rugby's in my mind because I was watching it at the weekend. It's the most recent thing I've seen. And Faf de Klerk, the Springbok scrum half, is constantly winding opponents up, chirruping and, you know, saying things and, you know, patting them on the head when they make mistakes and applauding them when they make mistakes and things like that. And you know, that is obviously designed just to make people slightly lose their reason, you know, not see things clearly, not think straight.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You've already mentioned Maradona's handball of 1986, which must be the most famous instance of successful cheating ever. But that's complicated because obviously it was cheating. The goals should have been cancelled. If there'd been VAR, he wouldn't have got it. But the thing, it would have been completely different for me if he hadn't scored that second goal as well. And that there's somehow that Maradona's two goals in that game need to be seen together. That he outjumps Shilton, who's 8 inches taller than him, to punch the ball into the net, gets away with it, fools the ref, doesn't fool the England defenders who, you know, mob the ref to no avail. And then 5 minutes later, he scores that other incredible goal where he takes the ball on the touchline and runs around everybody. And the two things, one of them, it seems to me, he says, well, okay, so I did get the handball, but even if you disallowed that, look, I can score goals like this too. But I also wonder if he would have been able to score that second goal if he hadn't got the first. Because his sense, I mean, not that Maradona needed much help in feeling omnipotent, but the idea that with the world watching, you can get away with that. I wonder how much of a sort of, I mean, the psychological bump from scoring anyway, how much that helped him score the second goal.
Yes, or another way you could look at it was that the second goal, which was an extraordinary piece of, you know, artistry, was his way of admitting that he cheated on the first. You know, that it was a sort of...
slightly apologetic.
Well, redemptive, you know, that I can do that, but I can also do this. But yeah, you totally, you know, that in a way his whole personality was summed up in those two goals side by side, you know, the kind of resourceful street kid thing and then the sort of moment of, you know, absolute transcendent football genius. And the other thing about him, I don't have any feeling about that first goal. You know, I thought, you know, overall, it's one of the most extraordinary games I've ever seen. And, you know, it was fair enough that Argentina won, really. But that era, you know, they get so much more protection now, the top players. The way that the tackle is refereed, the way that physical contact is managed and basically reduced. You know, there was more physical contact in that Euro 2020 than I've seen for a long time at the top level, because it got to a point where defender, you know, makes any contact at all with a forward and it's a free kick.
Well, Maradona, you know, he had his ankle broken.
Deliberately, yeah, by Michael Goicoechea, who then, you know, had a cabinet in his house where he displayed the boot with which he'd done it. You know, his ankle broken, his ligaments torn, he was out for a year, I think, completely deliberately. And that epoch of the game, the most talented player on the opposition side had they kicked the living shit out of them for 90 minutes. He was playing in an era that was very, very difficult. Same with Pelé, you know, who was... I can't remember which World Cup it was. I think it was it 58? And I think in the 62 one, he was 19, I think, in the first one. In the 62, he was sort of kicked off the pitch, you know. And for all that everyone remembers his flair and talent and artistry, he was very, very tough as well. And, you know, would routinely leave a foot out and catch defenders and, you know, make a point of, you know, you kick me, I kick you. And it's interesting, it's a counterfactual to think that what those guys who were absolute giants of the game, for me, Pelé, the greatest player ever to have played, up there with just slightly ahead of Messi in second place. But if you think of what players like Maradona and Pelé would have done now with the greater protection, they're given the greater emphasis on attacking football, you know, they would have scored half as many goals again. You know, they'd have really lit up the sky even more than they already did.
We talked a bit about rugby already, but one thing that someone tweeted about in response to your piece, talking about why no mention of Bloodgate, that moment when 2008 or 9, I can't remember, when the Harlequins player had a fake blood capsule in his mouth. But would that count? I mean, that's a kind of invisible cheating somehow, because to anyone watching, it looks like...
Oh, no, because that was sort of well outside the ethos. The only thing about that was that it was directed by management, which is slightly different. It wasn't a thing that emerged in the context of what happened on the pitch. You know, the detail of it was they faked an injury to get a player off the pitch so that someone else could come on and take a kick.
That's right. And then the injured player, having taken that, can come back on once the blood's been cleared up.
Was it at the... I don't know if he did come back on. I think it was at the end of the game, was it? And it was a... I've forgotten the details of it, but I think the crucial thing was the people who really got in trouble were the... rather tragically, actually, the doctor who signed off on it and the coach, Dean Richards, who was, you know, suspended for quite a while. And yeah, I mean, it was an interesting thing, Bloodgate, but for me, as I say, it was a sort of, as it were, it's a sort of executive level decision rather than something that emerged from what was happening on the field.
So it's closer to the Calciopoli, it's closer to the Italian managers fixing who refs which match and stuff. It's that kind of...
I mean, there was a recent thing in the Six Nations in rugby with, actually, no, it wasn't the Six Nations. I've seen it in French rugby. I'm trying to remember what it was. But a couple of things recently have come up with whether players have genuine head injuries. Because rugby has a slight tangle about when players can be, who've been substituted, can go back on the field. And you sometimes get these, you know, apparent misunderstandings or not, that, you know, someone's gone off for a head injury and then it turns out he'd be very useful for a scrum. And he either recovers from the head injury or someone else gets injured. And if someone else gets injured and it's dangerous to play on, which usually means it's an injury in the front row, you can bring the player who was taken off back on, but only if it was a substitute, not if it was a head injury assessment. So, and there have been a couple of instances like that recently, which again, you know, which are, in my view, both against the ethos in the game and are cheating. But they're slightly things that the management decides to do. They're kind of, you know, it's as it were the boss class manipulating the rules rather than something that the players have cooked up.
And the ball tampering, Australia's ball tampering in cricket, was that not management level as well, or was that?
They would say not.
Okay, there's no evidence that it was. Yeah.
But that's part of why that's been very damaging for Australian cricket, because you know, I don't think there are many people who follow the game closely who really buy the official account of Cricket Australia that, you know, as this is the only time in the history of Australian cricket that they ever tampered the ball and they just happened to be caught on television. Ball tampering is complicated though, because it's gone on forever.
And also there's a line, because obviously there are some things you are allowed to do with the ball. I mean, you're allowed to polish one side of it and those sorts of things. I mean, what are you allowed to do to the ball and what are you not? And even, you know, the fact that you begin the gradual decay of the ball over the course of a match is part of the game.
No, I know. And then the players do things like throwing it in very hard with one bounce instead of throwing it direct to the wicketkeeper to scuff it up more, which is within the rules. And then, you know, actually scratching it up isn't. I mean, there was the great Pakistan team that invented reverse swing in cricket. You know, Pakistan's a hard place to play cricket when, you know, the pitch dries out and the initial shine has gone off the ball. It's 38 degrees. I think some of the mysteries of how the Pakistan greats got to invent this thing of the ball swinging the other way as the physics of the shininess and heaviness changed. You know, it might all be clean living and virtuous thoughts, or there might be something else to it. But actually, you know, who cares? It was one of the glories of cricket, and it's really, as it's entered the game, it sort of, in my view, made it more interesting, because, you know, I think in some respects at the top level, cricket had got too weighted towards the batsman, and it's quite boring watching people just grind out huge totals over and over again over 5 days. I was a bowler, so I would say that. But yeah, it's by and large, it's a pretty venial sin, in my view, doing small things to the ball in cricket, because it's checked after every wicket. If you watch cricket, you notice they roll the ball, chuck the ball to the umpire after the fall of every wicket. So there are limits on what can be done. And, you know, the thing that made the Australian thing really blow up was the culture around it, you know, the way they behaved around it, I think, more than the actual moment.
And the sledging.
And the fact that they've been kind of as it was slightly self-appointedly, have this sense of, you know, we know where the line is. And everyone else felt, well, actually, no, you're way over it all the time. And there was a thing with sledging that teams from some cultures regard, you know, that kind of abuse, often quite personal abuse, as a form of cheating in itself, you know, saying horrible things to people, impugning their honour, sometimes saying horrible things about their families. You know, what some teams regarded, Australian teams would regard as, you know, playing hard but fair within the rules. And they had very abrasive relationships with some, particularly subcontinental teams, for whom those things were way over the line, you know, incredibly personally offensive, and therefore a form of cheating.
What about in cricket the practice of man-cadding, where when the batsman, the one who isn't, the non-facing batsman, starts creeping up the wicket and the bowler sort of runs him out by tapping his wicket with the ball?
Well, there's always a tremendous amount of outrage when it happens. In my view, I mean, I already said I belong to that oppressed subordinate class of bowlers. So from my point of view, it's completely fine to run the batsman out if he's trying to cheat and gain an unfair advantage. You know, the rules are really simple. He's got to stay within the crease until the ball's bowled. Batsmen routinely abuse it and sneak part of the way down the pitch. I think if he's doing that, from my perspective, yeah, run him out all day long, and twice before breakfast. But the one thing I would say is that what seems to have evolved with that is that there's an informal code. As that thing, I suppose, again, we're in that area of difference between the ethos and the rules, that, you know, it's within the rules to run him out, but the ethos now is that you give a warning, that the bowler stops at the moment of delivery, the batsman's out of the crease, and he just holds the ball next to the stumps and says, look, you know, stop it. This is your last warning. Next time I'm going to run you out. And when they do that, I notice people, as it were, you know, allow the bowler to do the man counting. But yeah, from my point of view, I think, you know, it's one of those weird ways in which cricket's distorted in the batsman's favour. The rules are simple. Stay within the crease.
And the question of the bodyline bowling in the 30s, for example, that this idea that you things you you a gentleman doesn't do, or even more recently that those the bowling which the, where the ball is just goes at the batsman's head time after time again, that high bouncing ball towards the and appears aimed at the head, which is within the rules and within the ethos.
Well, you're allowed a finite number. They do step in. I mean, the thing about the body line was it was within the rules, but it was against the ethos. And you mentioned the idea of it, you know, the gentlemanliness, that part of the thing with that is there was a strong class component to it, because Douglas Jardine, the captain, was posh and acted posh, and there were little signifiers of that. And one of the things being, in those days, they still had gentlemen versus players matches. And one of the ways you could tell teams apart was that the players were white, but the gentlemen wore cream. They wore cream linen. And Jardine wore cream, and he was posh and let everyone know it. And there's a very good book, very good biography by Duncan Hamilton about Larwood, Harold Larwood, the fast bowler, who implemented the bodyline strategy. And who subsequently, actually, when he retired, he went to live in Australia, rather wonderfully. But at the time, he got a lot of the blame. You know, Jardine's idea, Larwood was the enforcer, and there was lots of opprobrium directed at Larwood, especially afterwards, which, you know, he didn't at all deserve. But in that book, Duncan Hamilton he pays attention to that thing about the class, that, you know, as it was the officer giving the orders and the non-com soldier executing them, that was quite an important part of the dynamic. And it was the posh bloke, the gentleman, who was just completely ripping up the spirit of the game. You know, he was the one who's... And it's probably the case that a player couldn't have done it, that only someone who felt that they were above it, sufficiently above it to want to execute a win-at-all-cost strategy, that in a weird way it was only the posh person who had permission to do that.
One need only look to 10 Downing Street to see that.
Yeah, that there's a sort of separate code for us, as opposed to them. Yeah, definitely.
John Lanchester, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Tom.
You can read John Lanchester's piece in the latest issue of the LRB, along with Alison Light on Barbara Pym, a never-before-published piece by Patrick Lee Fermer on the Manny Peninsula, and Gary Young on Baltimore.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.